You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over the last decade, the music, movie, television, publishing, and newspaper industries have been in crisis due to lost revenue in the new digital economy. And that has led Robert Levine to call his new book, Free Ride, How Digital Parasites Are Destroying the Culture Business and How the Culture Business Can Fight Back. It's published by one of those threatened publishers, Doubleday, and brings Robert Levine to our show now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much.
And you don't pull punches. I don't know whether you wrote that title.
I did. It's the title in the UK is a bit different. It doesn't use the word parasites, but I think it's a very fair description.
You used to be the executive editor of Billboard magazine. Is that when you began thinking about this? A couple of threatened industries involved there.
People ask why I wrote a book, and I said I was sick of doing something really easy like working for a music magazine. But, you know, it's something that happened about 6-7 years ago. I worked at Wired. I was a feature editor there, and I very much believed that the digital economy represented an endless stream of opportunities for all these businesses. Over the years, it didn't happen. I started to question it.
Well, at Billboard, you watched serious changes in the music business. How much has it changed over the past decade?
I think completely. I mean, you've seen labels consolidate. You've seen bands get dropped, executives get let go. Some of this is sort of don't cry for me. These people made a lot of money. But I do think that it affects the culture you get. I mean, you have great bands who can't hire a producer to make a great album. They can't get the sound they want. And the example I always use is the Beatles. They were great songwriters, incredibly talented, but, you know,
they needed George Martin.
To bring their vision to life required George Martin. He was not volunteering.
On the other hand, a lot of people, as you suggested earlier, won't be crying about the fate of the major labels because the artists have been complaining about the way they've been treating them and doing business for years.
Yeah, I think some of that is everyone complains about everybody. To some extent, it's negotiation. To some extent, there's an ethic of suspicion of anyone making money in pop music. But to some extent, it's like even if the major labels are greedy and stupid, and I'm not necessarily agreeing, I think that's half true, they still have rights. People say they hate big companies, and I always ask, what market cap is it that you hate them above?
So why have they been losing money in the digital age? Aren't they selling records on iTunes and on Amazon and other venues?
Oh, it just doesn't add up. I mean, you've seen in the U.S., they sell half as much music as they used to, measured by the financial value of it on a wholesale basis. So, you know, when people bought CDs, if they wanted something, they pretty much had to buy it, and they bought it by the album. On iTunes, well, first of all, now they don't have to buy it. They can pirate it. Realistically, there's not so many consequences. And they can buy singles. In some ways, that might be good. In some ways, I think it's really led to a hollowing out of people able to make albums as albums.
Well, couldn't the record labels and artists just have sold their albums online without having to go through a middleman like iTunes?
It's interesting. A lot of people think that. I think it's more difficult than people realize. You know, again and again, you have people from the technology business say, why can't they do this? But, you know, we have antitrust laws. So when the labels negotiated with iTunes or anybody, they all go to a hotel. Each label gets a separate suite. And the people from the, from the technology company will go and talk to them each in separate rooms. Because if you're negotiating together in the same room, it's an antitrust violation. That's really serious. It applies to newspapers, book publishing, any of these businesses. And people who say, why can't they just do X, they either don't understand or they're just having a shortcut with the truth.
Well, some artists have tried new strategies. Nine Inch Nails, Jack White self-released their work. Radiohead did their Pay What You Wish release on In Rainbows in 2007. Did they help?
They certainly help those bands. I mean, I think there's a very bright future there for artists who want to go it alone. I mean, one of the things, you know, way back in the mid-90s, if you can remember when the VCR was dominant and CD-ROMs were new, as someone who was on the internet at the time, I thought artists could reach out directly to consumers. They wouldn't need labels, or they could choose whether or not they wanted one. That's great. I really support that. What worries me is that it's very hard for artists to do that, first of all. And second of all, you know, Trent Reznor, Radiohead, Jack White, they all had major labels who invested a lot in making them superstars.
Mm-hmm. So they could count on that, all of that PR that had gone in to make them famous to help them sell their own records.
I always tell the story. When OK Computer, the Radiohead album, was about to come out, I worked at Rolling Stone Online at the time, and they sent out a couple hundred Walkmans, Sony Walkmans, with the cassette of OK Computer glued inside so you could listen to it on headphones, sort of the way it was meant to be listened to. I know it's hard to believe, but at the time, a Walkman was, I don't know, maybe $40 or $50. They sent out 200 of them. This wasn't done for free.
In your introduction, you quote Stuart Brand's famous line, "Information wants to be free." How has that come to shape the current digital business model?
Well, you know, he didn't mean it literally, and I don't think it shaped it literally.
Well, you say it was taken out of context.
Yeah, it was. I mean, what he meant was there's this tension between the cost of spreading information, which is pretty much free, and the cost of creating information, which can still be very expensive. You know, you'll hear people say, I don't want to pay for digital music because making a copy and sending it out over the internet costs nothing. Okay, what about recording the album in the first place? Recording is also a lot cheaper, but that's not the case with movies. Certainly not the case with a fine book like mine, for example. You know, even though it's pretty much free to send out the Kindle edition, someone, namely myself, actually had to write the damn thing in the first place.
Well, how much of an impact has Generation Y, the children of the baby boomers, had on the philosophy of this open digital culture?
I don't think as much as people think. I think technology companies had a bigger influence. Technology companies had a bigger influence on Generation Y. I mean, when file sharing first became popular, you had executives from the Consumer Electronics Association say, there's nothing wrong with this. Now you have executives at Google saying, there's nothing wrong with this. You know, this is a great example. At Harvard, Google gives a lot of money to the Berkman Center for the Internet and Society. And most people there believe that things should be free. Copyright is over. And most of them are in their 30s to 50s, I would guess. The Harvard Crimson, the student newspaper, ran a piece, I think last year, it might have been the year before, praising the MPAA, saying copyright infringement is wrong. So the students who are, you know, 18 to 21 agree with me. And the people at the Berkman Center say, you know, we know what the young people think, but they're mostly older than I am.
Well, Stuart Brand said that to Steve Wozniak, didn't he, when he was still at Apple? Is that something that became part of the Apple philosophy?
I don't think so. I mean, Stuart Brand, that saying evolved. I think Apple is the least of these companies. You know, I would separate. There are companies like Apple and Netflix, which have arguably had a negative impact on the businesses of entertainment companies, but have very much respected the way they do business. They have generally respected copyright. You've seen some impolite negotiations. You're greedy, you know you're greedy, but usually within certain boundaries. Then you have Google, or on a non-copyright level, the Huffington Post, which is sort of like, you're old and stupid. You need to die. We are the future. And that's a very different thing. You would never hear Steve Jobs say that. Sorry to go on. There was this great piece on Rolling Stone Online with Steve Jobs talking about how much he loved the Beatles and Bob Dylan. And I read that, and you could tell he really loves music. Does Eric Schmidt have any idea who any of these bands even are? He's obviously a brilliant man, but this stuff doesn't resonate with him. He just thinks it's a bunch of bits.
My guest is Robert Levine. His book, Free Ride, How Digital Parasites Are Destroying the Culture Business and How the Culture Business Can Fight Back. It's published by Doubleday. So let's talk about copyright. Copyright is something that has been a basic part of our law for a long time, and we understand it. I create something, and I should be able to protect my ownership of it, and I'm given a limited amount of time to do that. It's like a patent, only a cultural patent. So why why does anybody see that as something that should be violated? The artist has to make money from his or her work, don't they?
I'm so glad we've settled this. No, I mean, I think that there are two opposing philosophies on this, but I don't think there's really too much. There's not really two opposing philosophies as much as there are two opposing economic interests. If you're an artist and you make money selling your work or licensing it out, I mean, I licensed my work to Random House, but it certainly benefits. That was my choice. It benefits me. That's one side. And the other side are people who distribute this stuff. What's a better business than distributing media with permission? Distributing media without permission. If you don't have to pay for what you're distributing, hey, your margins are great. This isn't evil. It's business. But the law should restrain you.
But even people who are working respecting copyrights, like Amazon, for example, they can offer lower prices than traditional bookstores because of their business model. On the one hand, should we feel sorry for Barnes & Noble and Borders? Didn't they do the same sort of thing to neighborhood bookstores? But it's very difficult to set one price for a book. I don't know how much your book is selling for, but I suspect that...
But it's a bargain at that price.
I suspect that whatever the price is, it's going to be offered for a lot less in a lot of different venues.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's gets out of copyright a bit. You know, traditionally, the purpose of antitrust law has been to protect consumers to keep prices down. So we don't protect consumers from low prices. Perhaps we should. You know, a lot of countries in Europe have what's called a net book price law. The UK used to, Germany still does. You can't discount books beyond a certain amount. And these countries have very healthy book businesses with many more small stores. I don't know whether people would want that, but it's interesting to think about.
Well, some people think it's inevitable that eventually many things will be offered free through digital media. But wouldn't Malcolm Gladwell probably disagree that it's a race to zero in his review of Wired magazine editor Chris Anderson's book called Free? Gladwell wrote, "Free is just another price, and prices are set by individual actors."
It's, you know, well, first of all, I'd obviously be very flattered if Malcolm Gladwell agreed with me. I think he's a great writer. But and although I would quibble with one thing, you know, are prices set by individual actors? In a functioning market, yes. On the internet as it is now, I don't think that's the case. If much more music is downloaded illegally than purchased legally, I don't think individual actors are really setting prices.
So what happens to the artist? Does the artist just simply have to accept the fact that there's no money to be made for the work that they've been doing?
Well, I think there are other ways to make money. A lot of those...
In the old days, you used to go on tour to promote the record. Now,
you release a record to promote the tour. I don't think, you know, for musicians, this might not be such a bad thing as it is compared to other artists. I mean, I think as a musician, you can sell T-shirts, you can perform live. As a book author, I mean, look at this face. Is anyone going to wear a T-shirt with this face on it? I have a hard time believing
that. Grow your hair
that.
A little longer and maybe you can get away with it.
I'll give it a shot.
Tony, one of our listeners, asks, if an old-fashioned CD is sold for $15, how much did the artist get?
Very little, usually about between $1 and $1.50 as a recording artist. If they wrote all the songs, they get about another dollar.
Well, they get 4 cents a track or something like that.
10 cents a track, about.
That's what it is now?
About. But I would argue that
there's... used to be in the business, it was lower.
There's another way to look at it. You know, my royalties are low, too, if you look at it that way. The way you should be looking at it is, what else do you get from the label? Publicity, promotion, marketing, distribution. And they lend you money. The example I use is, I probably get $4 a hardcover. If I'd gone into a bank and said, I'd like to write a book, would you lend me some money? They'd laugh at me.
The big problem for some artists, later we were going to be talking to Butch Walker, when he was still with a group, they had a hit record and Elektra didn't promote it, and the record died. And their feeling was that they'd been let down by their label, and I've heard that kind of story many times.
Look,
I've seen it with writers as well. The book comes out, gets great reviews, but the publisher decides another book should be promoted. And
I'm the last person, you know, one of the tough things about this book is a lot of people think I'm defending the traditional media companies. I'm not. I'm defending, you know, for 300 years we've had a functioning market for intellectual property. I think we still need one. What that
you
market,
think it's endangered?
Yeah, I think if you look online, it's endangered. You know, what that market looks like, if one record company is doing a bad job, let another record company do a better job. That's the free market.
Robert Levine is was the executive editor of Billboard. He's written for Vanity Fair, Rolling Stone, and the arts and business sections of the New York Times. And he's written a book called Free Ride, How Digital Parasites Are Destroying the Culture Business, How the Culture Business Can Fight Back. It's published by Doubleday. We will take a little break and we'll come back with more and also find out how you think they can fight back. We're back with Robert Levine, who's written a book called Free Ride, How Digital Parasites Are Destroying the Culture Business and How the Culture Business Can Fight Back. It's published by Doubleday. Who are some of the digital parasites you're referring to here, Robert?
Well, you know, it's a strong term, and I giggle a bit about it, too. But it's, you know, people who are making money off the work of others without compensating them, without their permission. You know, people have given a very rough time to record labels. When you sign a deal with a record label, it's a contractual relationship. This is not the 50s where they were signing illiterate people the contracts they didn't understand. This is, you know, people decide, yes, I want this contract. No, I don't. Often it doesn't work out the way they want. That's really bad. It's obviously awful for people, but it's a contract. It's not a non-permission.
Well, would you call the Huffington Post a parasite, a parasitic organization?
To a large extent, yeah. I mean,
people are thrilled when the Huffington Post posts their article, their work of art, whatever.
Yeah, I don't think. Well, first of all, to some extent, if they want to do that, that's great. If they are thrilled, that's great. I think for news organizations, I mean this in a pretty narrow sense, and the Huffington Post does its own reporting. If you look at their most popular items in the day page, it's usually pictures of starlets in bikinis. I have no problem with that at all. But, you know, a lot of what they do is they summarize news from the New York Times, the Washington Post, other organizations like that. I don't have a moral problem with this. I'm not thumping my shoe on the table. But if you report and half the money you get goes to another organization, at some point, where do you get the money to keep reporting? That's the problem.
What about YouTube? Same kind of problem?
Yeah, and I think it's also complicated. I think if you look at YouTube as a website, as a piece of the culture, it does some exciting things that are amazingly cool. If you look at it as a business, the business was built on copyrighted material as a business. Now, they would say, and this gets very complicated very quickly, they would say, how can we look at the 48 hours of video that are uploaded every minute? I don't think that's – and you know, the media companies want to shut down YouTube. Maybe they're right about the latter. I don't think media companies should shut down YouTube. I don't think YouTube should be allowed to do whatever they want either. I think you need a solution in the middle.
What about record labels? Because YouTube also provides an awful lot of non-video recordings. You could, if I'm looking for some old record, I could just type in the name of the artist and the song, and there's a good chance that it's available on YouTube.
Does that make you more or less likely to buy it?
Well, it's more or less likely to then download it without paying for it. What about Napster? Napster was a business game changer, and it influenced the way generation thought about gaining access to media, didn't it?
I think it may have introduced a generation of venture capitalists more than a generation of consumers, and that it told people that you can start a business without compensating people, and you may be able to make money. There's a thing in my
book. Napster's not around anymore.
No, Napster was sued out of existence. There's the famous, Lars Ulrich of Metallica shows up at Napster, and he basically says, these people are trying to sell to a big media company and make a lot of money. And, of course, Lars Ulrich looked really bad, rich rock star, picking on kids. But what he said He looked bad. But what he said was right. They were trying to make money. Should they have been allowed to make money without compensating artists?
You cite several important cases and laws that have led to the digital economy in its current state. Let's talk a bit about the Betamax case.
The Betamax case was a very important case and a very misunderstood case because it basically, you know, before then, copyright law, specifically the fair use exception in copyright law, the fair use was really there to square copyright with freedom of speech. How can you quote from a book as a critic? How can you take a scene from a movie as a film critic? That was fair use. It protected your freedom of speech as a commenter on something. The Betamax case, to a lesser extent, some other cases, but the Betamax case really presented fair use as a consumer right. You have the right to tape, to time shift was the word that, I think that was the word from the court, free television programs for later use. Notice it did not say anything about cable television. You can time shift free television programs for later use. And it established this idea that you have a fair use, quote unquote, right, although I wouldn't call it a right, and most lawyers wouldn't either, to do with your media as you wish. And this started a lot of questions about what fair use means. We're still answering them today.
Now, you made the point that they didn't say anything about cable, but a lot of people would record movies from HBO and some of the other premium channels.
Of course.
And in a sense, you're saying that was theft?
I wouldn't call any copyright infringement theft. I think it's the wrong word to apply. And I wouldn't put any moral judgment on it. It's just I'm not someone could, but that would have to be someone who's not a business writer. It was technically illegal, but I think what happened was the court got into a sense of, do we want to extend copyright law? Copyright law always governed the public sphere. What can you do with something commercially? And it was you were regulating the copy because the copy was what you regulated. But the purpose was to give you a monopoly on money making, not a monopoly on consumption or enjoyment. The court was afraid of taking copyright law and bringing it into people's houses. In most other countries, when you buy, there's a levy on VCRs or blank tapes. That money goes to compensate artists. We don't have that in the U.S., but I think just about every country in continental Europe does.
It's been proposed here. And
sure.
It's never passed. So the court decided to let us tape whatever we wanted.
Well, the court decided to let us tape free TV. We decided to let ourselves tape whatever. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. One other thing I want to say is people say, a lot of bloggers say, look, the studios are so dumb. They were worried about the VCR for nothing. But let's look at this for a second. What the studios were worried about was your ability to record television. Studios didn't really make much money on that. They probably lost a little, but not too much, because the VCR was really not used that widely to record television. Most of the VCRs in this country blinked 12 o'clock all the time. The VCR was used to rent movies, to buy movies. Studios made money on that. So what they made money on wasn't what they sued for. Then the DVD came along. They made more money on the DVD because you had rental and ownership without, quote-unquote, taping.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
then you could start recording on the DVD as well. Now there's Blu-ray that's replacing the DVD. So
sure.
DVDs have replaced the VCR. I don't see Blu-ray replacing DVDs. But still, the sense for the public is that every time we have made a commitment for some new technology, they come up with a further, quote, advancement.
Yeah, I think it's a little different. You know, DVDs and Blu-ray were things that the studios worked on. They were the outcome of, industry consortiums were involved. The VCR, that was not the case. And people say if the studios had defeated the VCR, we would never have been able to watch movies at home. That's hogwash. They were working on the Laserdisc at the same time. I'm not arguing that the outcome of the case was bad, just that the common understanding of it is very simplistic.
Did Congress create YouTube?
I think in a sense. Now you know who to blame for all those Miley Cyrus videos. You know, in 1998, Congress passed a law called the DMCA. It did a bunch of related things, but one of the most important things it did was it established this notice and takedown. If there's copyright infringement, as long as a site or a service behaves in a certain way, they get safe harbor from copyright infringement. You as a copyright holder have the right to notify them. They have to take it down. This was intended to apply to internet service providers to let Verizon and AT&T spend millions of dollars investing in, you know, high-speed data transfer services. Those companies aren't very popular, but those investments needed to be made to bring us into the 21st century. There's a lot of other reasons why the law is good, because you don't want people afraid of doing something innovative. On the other hand, if you look at the amount of stuff that's up on a lot of these services, it's now turned into, we have it anyway, let's make you a lowball offer because you can't stop us from using it anyway. That's not a functioning market. We need a functioning market.
Well, didn't Congress also pass the Copyright Term Extension Law Act?
A lot of people relate those. I think the Copyright Term Extension Law was pretty stupid. What was really bad about it was that it extended the term retroactively. So copyright is supposed to be, in U.S. law, it's supposed to be an incentive to create. They extended copyright protection for works from creators that were already deceased, who obviously because they were dead, couldn't very well be incentivized to create anything. That was a corporate giveaway. But one of the things I say in my book, it's controversial, is corporate giveaways work both ways. Disney got a lot out of the government, so did Google.
Right now what we're seeing is the traditional media trying to adjust. The New York Times pretty much insists that every one of its reporters also do some blogging. Is that the way that the traditional media can fight back?
I actually don't think so. I think that's a useful thing to do, but let me step back a bit to show you how I phrase the problem. The common way to phrase the problem is, they need to get with the internet. But their level of hip modernity is not a financial problem. The problem with the Times is, in print media, there's a limited amount of space for advertising, i.e. limited supply. Demand is pretty consistent. Supply and demand advertising is dear. On the internet, the supply of potential ad space is limitless. Demand doesn't change. The percentage of advertising, the percentage of money spent on advertising as a percentage of GDP has remained relatively consistent since the 50s. The New York Times is going to get less and less of that. They need to make money in another way. Twitter and Facebook don't bring in that much money. Charging does. I'm not saying don't Twitter and Facebook. Those are very important. But those get you engagement. What the Times needs is not engagement. What the Times needs is revenue.
Well, do you see the plan that the Wall Street Journal has imposed as being a better idea?
Which one, in terms of?
Well, the Times is doing it too, isn't it? You pay for some things and not others. People screamed their heads off when these newspapers started charging, but
why? Sorry, yeah, exactly, yeah. Why?
Because they were used to getting it for free.
Yeah,
the Wall Street Journal calls it a freemium.
Yeah, I think here's the thing. Newspapers need to find a way to bring in revenue. The best way to bring in revenue without affecting the quality of your journalism is to charge people for news. You need to do that. Now, there's all kinds of discussions about what you should charge for and what you should have for free, but that's really just a discussion of promotion.
Now, should we be crying for the newspapers? There was an article over the weekend by David Carr in the New York Times about the bonuses that the Tribune Company and Gannett executives are getting. The Tribune Company could amount to $115 million, despite the fact that the company is declaring bankruptcy and its newspapers are struggling.
We shouldn't – look, I mean, it's a very tough question in a way. It's a good question. Do I cry for – the senior executives at Tribune or Gannett? No, they're ridiculously overcompensated, and they're, quite honestly, they're pretty dumb. Do I cry for the employees of Tribune and Gannett because they're the ones who suffer? Yes. But I think one of the things I really tried to say in the book, and it's a hard point to make, is that in the U.S., being greedy and stupid does not affect your rights under the law. So if I'm a good person, I have the copyright to works I create. If I'm a bad person, I still have the same rights. You know, people always talk about how bad record labels are. As someone who's covered music, I'll tell you, some artists are not as nice as they seem either. And you know what?
I've met a few of them.
It doesn't matter. We all have the same rights under the law, and that's really what I'm trying to get at.
So do you oppose net neutrality because the culture is not just a bunch of bits? Some information is more important than others?
I think it's a solution in search of a problem.
So what are the solutions that you've come up with that you're proposing?
Well, I think we need some legal regulation on the internet. It's a very difficult thing to legally regulate, but we have to start talking about how we want to do that.
You know, people are going to scream bloody murder if anybody actually proposes that. And right now, Congress is talking about deregulating everything.
Yeah, I think that's pretty foolish. I mean, every time you try to enforce copyright law online, people start screaming about free speech. But one of the things we have to realize is even if you think copyright isn't necessary, there are other things that we're going to have a legitimate legal interest in limiting on the internet. For example, if you're the head of a public company, you say a certain thing in a certain way at a certain time, go to jail, don't collect $200, don't pass go. Insider trading securities law regulates free speech. It is illegal to promote certain stocks in certain ways. We need some kind of limit. And in the U.S., a lot of that's done by litigation, which is a pretty good system because it's cheap because it doesn't involve legal resources. We need some way to enforce the laws of the U.S. inside the U.S. and make sure that people from other countries aren't violating them.
Much of the criticism you've received for this book has been about the way you've discussed Google.
Sure.
Why are people so angry with you? Especially Lawrence Lessig, the founder of the Stanford Center for Internet and Society.
Well, I think people aren't used to, you know, this is my take on it, obviously, so make of it what you will. You know, I'm a business writer. I wasn't for a while, now I am a business writer. To me, if you're not writing about every company as a fundamentally self-interested institution whose primary purpose is generating profit for shareholders, you're kidding yourself. People write about record companies as bad and Google as good. They're all companies. They all want to make money. And guess what? If you're trying to do the right thing instead of make money, it's arguably a breach of fiduciary duty to shareholders. It's the job of a company to make money. That's why our economy is relatively healthy. It's the job of the government to make sure that in your request for profit, you don't trample other people's. Right. So I think people have some unrealistic ideas about what it is that they're doing in the Googleplex. They want to make money. People have to realize that.
One of our listeners, Amy, asks, where do Creative Commons licenses fit into all of this?
Creative Commons licenses are deals with the devil. No, I'm sort of kidding a little. You know, Creative Commons licenses are very misunderstood. They are compliant with copyright law. They're not a replacement for copyright law. Creative Commons offers you a way to give up your rights under the law. Now, you might ask, why would I want to give up my rights? And the answer is, Now, the other answer is, who's promoting the idea that artists should give up your rights? Well, gosh, if you look at the board of directors of Creative Commons, 15 people, I believe. Could be wrong. I believe it's 15. You find how many artists? One. The vice chair of Creative Commons, Esther Woodsicki, I might be mispronouncing her name, in which case I apologize, Sergey Brin's mother-in-law. The organization gets a lot of money from Google and other technology companies. So it's an interesting idea. A lot of people use it well. It could be a valuable tool. The question is, are those licenses in your interest any more than a record label deal is? And I think it's the same thing. If you're an artist, you better read that contract twice because someone whose job it is to make money is doing something in their interest, not yours. The goal of Creative Commons, donating your work, is important and noble, and I very much agree with it. But if that's going to be done in an organized way, if that's a serious organization, it needs a board that's more representative of artists.
So, Robert, what do you think we'll be in 5 years from now? I suspect that all the things you're complaining about will have gotten worse, if anything.
I'd hate to be seen as complaining. I think I'm reporting on a bad situation. I hope I'm not complaining. I think there are some reasons for optimism. I mean, look at how many people said the New York Times paywall would never work. Jeff Jarvis thundered against it. Michael Wolff thundered against it. Any number of people on the internet said it was a suicide mission. Guess what? It's working. The Financial Times charging for information. It's working. One of the reasons media companies are in trouble is because there's no functioning market on the internet. The other reason is that they bought into a philosophy which gives them no power that I don't think they should have bought into.
Robert Levine's book, Free Ride, How Digital Parasites Are Destroying the Culture Business and How the Culture Business Can Fight Back, is published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's been really fun.
Thank you so much.